You're listening to highlights from OTB AM, Off the Ball's new daily breakfast show. It's live every weekday morning from 7:45. Watch us on Facebook, YouTube or Twitter, or listen live at offtheball.com.
Let's go back to the rugby. I'm going to speak with Alan Quinlan in just a minute to get his thoughts on what the hell went wrong, but also a bit about what went right for Ireland against South Africa, because ultimately, if we're not having a World Cup here, we may as well concentrate on winning the World Cup on the pitch. Dick Spring, part of the organising committee from an Irish perspective, very much disappointed with the votes that went against Ireland's bid to host 2023.
Are you still unhappy with the point system in that process?
Yeah, we'd have to be in terms of... there were a number of issues that we felt we didn't get deservedly recognised. And I think that's one we'll have to bear up with for foreseeable future.
And how disappointed are you that you didn't get the backing of some of the home nations?
Personally, I am extremely disappointed. I would have thought that there was room for solidarity between the home nations, given the history of the game, I think extremely disappointing.
Yeah, so Dick Spring there. I think capturing the mood of the organising committee, and fair enough, I think the volunteers come out of it really well, but the top brass of the IRFU are going to have to answer a lot of very difficult questions. The fact that Leo Varadkar was so heavily personally invested in it from the get-go, I think probably means that there won't be too much of official political repercussions unless the opposition ramp it up, and they're not really going to do it because it's difficult, it's a bit boring, and there's no easy wins on it.
Well, what I would say is that you look at South Africa 95 and they had the thrust of Nelson Mandela behind that. Ireland probably kind of looked at that and they were like, right, let's get all our big figures behind this as well. Will they be able to get as much investment kind of personnel-wise for another World Cup bid? I'm not so sure they will. Yeah. They might be able to get Liam Neeson to do another voiceover, but that's potentially about it.
Yeah, okay. Let's get some reaction from Brian O'Driscoll. Here he is talking to Neil Tracy for offtheball.com.
It's been said by other members of the Oversight Board in the last few minutes, it was particularly disappointing not to get the votes you expected from your Celtic neighbours.
Yeah, well, yeah, we can't be certain, but the feeling is, well, Scotland set out their stall early saying that they were going to go with the money, whoever was offering the most money, and then Wales, more recently felt as though they had to sway with Gareth Davis, who sits on a Rugby World Cup board, with their decision of South Africa. So to lose, the likelihood to lose both of them, yeah, it's pretty disappointing. But we got the support of England, and we definitely appreciate that. But England alone weren't ever going to get us across the line.
And what was the gut feeling just before they were actually announcing who won the rights to host it?
I wasn't overly expectant, but you live in hope, don't you? And when there's one name written down on a piece of paper and it's turned over, until that moment, there's always a chance. I feel like Lloyd Christmas from Dumb and Dumber saying, there's always a chance, but one in a million. We were a bit better than one in a million, but it was... Even the celebrations, I thought, of France were pretty contained. Maybe they felt as though they were, the front runners over the course of the last couple of weeks.
And finally, for me, what kind of a tournament can we expect from France? Are they worthy hosts now?
Well, listen, they've done a good job in the past. They've held World Cup, football World Cups, football European Cups. So it's not that long ago that they had the Rugby World Cup in 2007. We don't have great memories of that, but. You can be sure that 2023 will be will give us better memories from our own perspective, and they'll do a top quality job as they've done in the past. So it's a shame from our perspective. Also, I'm sure South Africa are bitterly disappointed being the front runners and comfortably finishing second. But we accept the result and you get on with it.
It's Brian O'Driscoll speaking with Neil Tracy of offtheball.com. Yesterday, Alan Quinlan, good morning to you.
Morning, Ger.
We knew this was coming, I think, right? Did we know that we were getting screwed by the Scots and the Welsh? Is that why people are so pissed off this morning?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest disappointment. Your neighbours, when you're living at home, you rely on your neighbours, don't you? And I think it's very disappointing. That's the first kind of thoughts I got. A little bit of anger over that, because you think if they were trying to host a tournament, they'd be relying on us to try and support them,
yeah.
Particularly because it's so close. And you think there would be some benefit for them with people possibly coming
having
from
camps.
The Southern Hemisphere, staying in Scotland, staying in Wales, coming over, going over and back. So it's really disappointing, I think. And they were probably the 6 votes that would have swayed it for us, because we got 8. If you put Scotland and Wales, if we got the 2 of them, that brings us to 14 in round 1, which would have put us into round 2, and then we would have got possibly the South African...
Or enough, anyway.
We would have got enough then, maybe, to compete. But look, France obviously went out and lobbied very well in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
When I say the word lobbied, I'd be very careful what I say. But
should we not have, like, is that not the rules of the game, right? Were we too naive? Were we too above board, not thinking that the French were actually going to go and make significant offers of investment or whatever the soft lobbying is, however they've done it? Like,
I think this whole process is a joke, Ger. I think it's, you're talking about FIFA and Qatar and the way that whole thing has played out, and possibly Russia as well, and bribes. And we look back to South Africa in 2010, that there was money handed over and a lot of promises made. This is something similar, because it's horse trading for a tournament. They're all lobbying with each other. They're all promising fixtures and warm-up fixtures for World Cups and World Cups ahead. And that generates funds. And who knows what France, you know, the rumour was that France were offering TV rights to a lot of the countries, saying, look, you can have our free French rugby.
And World Rugby had to step in and say, oh, yeah, you can't do all that.
Yeah.
And like,
so, and if if that's getting out and about, imagine the possibility of other stuff that's going on.
And the,
with
the
blank checks landing on people's tables
the
as
Irish,
well.
The Irish and South Africa were both kind of going, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? What is this? Why did World Rugby come and warn it? And then eventually they thought that was something to do with the... with the TV rights. Now, we're not suggesting there's anything illegal happening. I would say that there isn't anything illegal happening here. I'd say this is just the kind of promise of, we will help support you to grow the game, and like, we can do that in a way.
But they're not breaking any rules and regulations by promising some help around their development in some of the, we'll say, for example, the Asia countries, where we believe France got the vote there, that they could very easily go and say, look, we'll fund some of your structures or your programs, and we'll help you, and we'll send some players.
And so why didn't we do that? Why were we not?
We probably did. We did. I think we did, but we probably didn't have the ability to go, well, here's, we can give you some money as well towards your programs. There's nothing illegal in it. It's morally probably wrong when you think you're in the middle of a process of voting for World Cup. I just don't think we had the financial might to compete against France. They were the biggest danger. When the technical review came out 2 weeks ago, speaking to a lot of people who had their finger on the pulse, they kept saying, beware of France, beware of France. Because And France obviously went out in the last 2 weeks and had the, you know, they offered more money initially in the bid, the participation fee, and, you know, they're talking about 17,000 jobs, 1 billion to the economy. It's they're just a massive country who have the money, and we probably don't have that ability to do that. But I think it's a farce, Ger, because what's the point in smaller nations ever competing for any of these tournaments again? It's a waste of time. Just give it to the big countries. Forget this whole process of, you know, the romanticism around a smaller country getting it.
But like, I actually think there is something in that, because you go to a soccer World Cup, and because it's the soccer World Cup and 40,000 fans from every country travel there, it takes over the country. But the Rugby World Cup is something much smaller. There's 12 countries really who send fans in any great numbers, and it's not even the same. So you could actually legitimately take over a country for 3 or 4 weeks, and it would be a proper rugby party. Like, that's what rugby should be doing, because then it would actually become this great thing. Like, when France hosts it, it's going to be all over France. There'll be a small coterie of fans in Toulon. There'll be 8 games in Paris. It's very diverse, and
they love their rugby in France, you know. I was involved in 2007, and it was a good Rugby World Cup. It's pretty easy to get around with the TGV.
It doesn't take over the country, though. There's
it doesn't.
No, sense
no
of
it doesn't. It does get lost a little bit, but they have the money, and the infrastructure is quite good there. So I think my point is, one of the things that we got knocked down on was experience of hosting a major tournament. Well, we'll never have experience if we don't get the opportunity.
Yeah, Cast 22.
It's not really in World Rugby's interest to give a country experience. That's not what it's there for. It's there to put on a brilliant
but
sporting
tournament. But it is important that they grow the game. They're trying to make it... They're up against... Soccer's a global game, and there's massive money in it. And they're definitely trying to expand rugby and get into different markets. So what does it say to those other markets that, look, we want you to get involved in rugby, we want to spend money, we want to expand the game there, but we'll never give a tournament there. It'll never happen again. They look at Japan as a mistake now because they're not going to make money out of Japan. The same interest is not going to be there, the same excitement, the same number of fans won't travel there. I think if it happened in Ireland, it would have been an incredible scenario. We got knocked in the stadiums, and this is a very valid point that I've made as well. If we were going to be knocked in stadiums, why didn't let us go through the process? Why let us get to this point? You know, tell us 2, 3, 4 years ago.
Lads, you don't
look,
need
if
come
your
back
stadiums
to us.
Are ready, come back to us when your stadiums are ready. We wouldn't have been in a position to do that. We wouldn't have just done up all the stadiums, GAA stadiums and stuff like that around the country with a potential possibility beforehand. If we got Rugby World Cup 2023, we would have been able to fund them and put it together.
But just going back to the report for a moment, like that just seems like the most pointless thing ever, because obviously the result doesn't go with the report, but also the aim of the report is to try and influence men in suits and their decisions. That was never going to happen.
Well, Owen, it's proved it's a farce, because South Africa were the recommended bid. They now have egg in their face, World Rugby, and they're saying, well, the process was fair. How fair is a secret ballot? It gives people the opportunity to trade votes and make promises. It's not transparent. I actually think, in the opposite, they should go with the technical review and have no vote. So bringing in have a situation where World Rugby look at the potential bidders like they did a number of weeks ago, bring in external people, sit down in the room and say, here's your winner. End of story.
Yeah.
This voting scenario then,
it
devalues it, and that's what's happened.
They could have just had the vote 5 years ago and gone, lads, who's going to get us? South Africa, France, Ireland. Sorry, Ireland, not your turn. You lads, France, get it.
And see, it takes away that possibility of that romanticism and that opportunity for a new venue, a new place, growing the game, because it's about money, and money is won out in the end. So, look, we've got to accept that. People, and it frustrates me to say, well, our bid wasn't good enough, and it was a stupid bid, and we were never going to get it. The recommendation says we could have hosted a wonderful World Cup here, and we were just beaten by two countries who have hosted major tournaments, have all the stadiums and stuff like that. So I think it was a great effort.
Is it naive to think, though, like you mentioned the Wales and Scotland thing, how that could have swung the entire thing in our favour?
Absolutely.
To think that we could just get on their side for another World Cup bid and...
Well,
like,
if you think about the Pro 14 as well, what does it say about the Pro 14 that... you know, our neighbours didn't vote for
Italy
us.
Italy didn't vote for us either.
Italy didn't as well. And Irish rugby's done a lot for Italy, Ger. A lot of support for Italy.
I'd say Italy probably feels like their best chance is to get into France, though, and get a club at the top
14. Probably. But I think this is going to linger on a bit. It's going to create a little bit of tension in the Pro 14 and amongst the home unions. I think England are probably our perceived biggest enemies.
Yeah.
Supported us, and that was a massive statement. They supported us, but we only got 8 votes, and I think if we'd got Scotland, Wales and Italy, we'd be having a World Cup here in 2023. So it's massive disappointment.
It's not good when your neighbours don't like you.
Yeah, well, they're saying, well, Scotland, and then we're kind of saying we're whining about it, but you would expect your neighbours to support you, wouldn't you? If you had a crisis at home in your house and you knocked on the door either side, you'd be hoping that they wouldn't close the door in your face. So look, it's more to it than that. Obviously, Gerald Davies is on World Rugby and so Wales supported him.
Yeah, I mean, they could have given 2 votes. They could have split their vote if they wanted to and said, actually, you know what, we've decided that you're getting a vote because actually it would be really good for the Pro 14 to show that one of our nations can host it and maybe Wales can get it sometime. Or maybe a joint Welsh-Scot bid, I don't know. It definitely doesn't suggest that the Pro 14 is on a very safe footing.
Yeah, and I think it's people have asked, will we go for 2027? Waste of time. Yeah, I think now, what is the point? Now, you can argue South Africa have gone for the last 3.
Yeah.
And how they're feeling. I think they should be more peeved off than anyone because they were the recommended bid. They have massive issues in the country. Same as we've economic problems here and different social problems, and every country has them, but... you know, being the recommended bid, that gave him a real shot in the arm 2 weeks ago, and then to have it taken away at the last minute was hugely disappointing.
We don't get a vote after we get knocked out, do we? It's like it's only the people.
We don't get a vote, no. But I think our votes would have transferred on to France because obviously, you know, anyone who voted kind of around here for England probably voted for France because again, there'll be a benefit to their economy as well.
Yeah, I think they did.
All right, let's hear what Philip Brown, the chief executive of the IRFU, had to say in the aftermath of Ireland's failed bid.
It's obviously hindsight and all that, but is there anything looking back that you might have done differently? No regrets or anything with the bid?
No, I think when we set out on this this journey, for want of a better term, we said, you know, regardless of what the result is, we want to be able to wake up the day after, look ourselves in the mirror and said we did absolutely everything we could, and I'm quite happy that we did absolutely everything we could.
And it's been worth bidding for regardless of the result?
It has. It's been worth bidding for, the whole process has been good for a number of reasons. Probably one of the greatest reasons, actually, is to see the governments, both North and South, and the public service in Northern Ireland and indeed in the Republic of Ireland, working together on a project that has no agenda other than an agenda they all support. And that in itself is very rewarding.
Given the low number of votes, especially from Ireland's neighbours, does that have any impact on the relationship with various governing bodies?
Listen, we were very disappointed that Scotland and Wales didn't support us. Very disappointed indeed. I think Scotland said that they were consistent in that they said they were going to vote for the bid that produced the greatest amount of money. And Gareth Davies obviously was part of the evaluation board for a process, and I think the Welsh Union felt duty bound and honour bound to support Gareth. But I mean, that damaged us significantly.
Is it disappointing to hear that a country bid and was pretty clear about bidding specifically because of the money?
Listen, every union has its own objectives and its own strategies, and that was Scotland's.
All right, Six Nations on and off the pitch is going to be pretty interesting next year. Let's move on to stuff on the pitch because we annihilated South Africa last week and everyone was like, yeah, that's great. And then the dust settled a bit and you go, geez, South Africa were terrible.
They were horrendous. There was a time when we feared South Africans, South African team. I think, and you've got to respect them as well. They've a lot of issues. They've over 300 players playing overseas, so it's very difficult to be constantly losing your best players. Perfect example was Yann Serfontein. He plays in the centre in the three tests that they beat France at home over the summer. He decides, I'm going to Montpellier, and do you mind if you release me from the November tour? I've got to go over and sign up for my new club and get ready there. And they agree to it because they've no choice.
Yeah.
So he was starting to have a really good partnership with Jesse Creel in the centre. Diallande played last Saturday for South Africa, number the 12 for South Africa. He was horrendous. There was one stage at a 4-on-1-2, probably Irish guys, bit of scramble defence, and he hacks it. A horrendous kick. Andrew Conway catches it and lamps it up the field. And I just thought, that's it. That's all they've got. Because they have a big, you know, powerful pack of forwards and a very impressive pack of forwards and potentially could be a very strong unit for a number of years. But again, they're 9 and 10, horrendous. Cronje, the Lions, he plays Super Rugby for the Lions, totally different game, but his pass is horrendous. And Yanchi's then the out half. So you've had 9, 10, 12 who are very, very poor. And that had, no matter how dominant or how much parity you get up front, you just can't play. So I think Joe Schmidt will realise that. A lot of the players will realise that afterwards. But it looked like a very solid, unified Irish group without setting the world on fire, because we've got to remember, Gerard, 69 minutes, it was 17-3. Conway got an opportunistic try and a bit of bad discipline from them. You know, so we weren't kind of running away with it. But they never troubled us, which was the concern for them.
You mentioned not setting the world alight there. Like, it seems we broke them down just by doing the basics very, very well. And I'm just wondering, how well prepared does the opposition have to be to stop an Ireland team that is doing the basics perfectly? Because it seems they're perfectly aware of what the game plan is, but they're powerless to stop it.
Yeah, and it's the minute things that they're powerless to stop, because Ireland are so efficient under Joe Schmidt around the breakdown, around their carries, around their presentation, around their support lines that they run. The detail there, and we hear this attention to detail all the time, they're just really excellent at knowing their role, affecting each breakdown, affecting each phase of play. And that's the emphasis he puts on. And no matter how much you know that, it's sometimes it's a 50-50 battle. You look at Rhys Ruddock's try. He's running straight at Francois Lowe. It's very quick, and he just puts a little bit of footwork on, and he's in the space. Try. You know, Francois Lowe, for all the world you think he's going to put in a big impact tackle, and he was one of the South Africans that I thought, you know, he's an honest, he's hardworking, he gives it his all, he plays well for Bath every week in the English Premiership. Just a little minute detail from Ruddock. That just doesn't happen. That's practice. That's trying to find the space all the time in the tight contact areas. James Ryan makes a tackle at a carry at one stage. Etzebeth and the Jaeger, it looks like he's going to get smashed. He just puts on that bit of footwork again and he gets through. And the result from that is quick play.
Yeah.
Presentation of the ball, quick play. I watched Tyke Furlong, you know, I was up high, I was doing the commentary, and I watched Tyke Furlong a couple of times for a tight head prop. The speed in which he enters the ruck, potential turnover, boom, clean out, win the ball. One man, you know, Keane Healy's clean outs. So these guys now, they're doing the basics really well. They're doing it better than most. Where do we fall down? Sometimes we play better team, more powerful team, a team who holds on to the ball really well and does a lot of that good stuff. England do it well under Eddie Jones. So, you know, good coaching at that level has made us very, very hard to beat. And I think we've unearthed some good young players as well now.
The Six Nations campaign last year, it wasn't great but got a bit of a free pass at the end. This year, there's much more pressure on the Six Nations campaign. It feels to me that like we legitimately have to be contending going to that final game on Paddy's Weekend.
Yeah, we got a pass, I think, last year, and we're not good chasing a game. And the reasons for that is we're not hugely expansive. We don't throw the ball around willy-nilly. There's a big emphasis on protecting the ball and being secure. And I know there's been a lot said about, you know, not taking risks. I don't buy into that fully. I think it's being more efficient rather than being more expansive at times. And getting the scoreboard ticking over. We're a very hard team to claw back against. So we got caught a little bit in the Six Nations, you know, against you know, the obviously we were caught in the hop in Scotland when we had an horrendous start, came back and then lost it again, you know, and the Welsh game. So, you know, you're going away to England and France this year. You've got to pick up one win there and win your home games. And four wins, then you're in the mix. So I think there is more pressure. There is a set case now of, particularly when you the South Africa game, we're creating a lot of depth within the squad.
I think that's really what this November is about, because the Fiji game this week, like, unless we lose that game, which you can't really see happening at the moment, there's not a whole heap now with South Africa being so poor. And let's see what Argentina are like. I don't expect them to be brilliant given their championship performances. So really this is just about creating depth this November.
Absolutely. I think first and foremost, you want to try and you look at any fixtures in November, and I've been involved in a few, and always the messages have been, well, we want to win the games first. That's the pressure coming from the RFU, because the international team fund the game here in Ireland. You want to win. So then the coaches have, you know, a bit of room for manoeuvre. What do the public want? What do they want first? What does the coach want around development? And of course, always the middle game is the weaker one, whether it's Canada, Georgia, Fiji, you know, whatever. They're perceived weaker team. And that's their time for big manoeuvring. So for Fiji this week, I think he'll make wholesale changes, probably a new 15.
You picked a team there, had you?
Yeah, Jack McGrath obviously comes back in. Then you've got James Tracy or Rob Herring. I think James Tracy would probably start. John Ryan, Andrew Porter could play tight head.
That'd be amazing, right?
Yeah, it's some kind of turnaround from being a loose head for the under-20s a couple of years ago to now being a tight head. He's a really powerful guy.
Does that make him rich in like the last five
very
or six years?
Very much so.
Of his career?
Rich. Well, having that versatility to be able to do both, tight head is the one. That's where the ching-ching is, Jared, the tight head. They're so vital. Then you've got James Ryan, maybe Kieran Treadwell. I think he'll definitely start Dalton Delane. It just depends whether he goes Treadwell or James Ryan.
I saw somebody in the paper today saying that James Ryan looks like a guy at the start of a 100 cap test career. I'm not sure do you agree with that.
I do. I think he's the key for any of these young guys coming through is the injuries. Staying, minding the bodies. You hear you hear O'Connell, you hear Earls, you hear these guys towards the end of their career, how they manage themselves. So if you can translate that kind of latter part of it and learn from some of those experienced guys to get it right now as a 21-year-old, getting the rehab done, doing the small little stuff rather than killing themselves with big weights or all this stuff, you know, O'Connell, that's been the key for him.
O'Connell talked about in the early stage of his career, he would get himself to this ferocious emotional pitch.
Yeah.
And he would go out and kill people in the first 20, 25 minutes of games. And he felt that that actually had an impact on his injury profile, that he got too intense, that actually later in his career, when he found a bit of calm, like obviously still the manic aggression was part of it, but like it's hard for a 20-year-old not to go, I've got to go out there and kill somebody to get noticed.
Yeah, it's having that balance right and looking after your body and your mind, Ger, because the talent is there. So how do you kind of maximise that talent? How do you manage that talent from week to week? Being in the Irish system will help James Ryan because he'll get breaks, he'll get the rehab, he'll be looked after right. And I think he's a fantastic future ahead of him. He's a really, really exciting player. I first saw him a couple of years ago when I worked for the under-20s, one of the under-20s games, and I just thought, geez, this guy's work rate, his tackle, his ability to reload, get back up, make another tackle, yeah. And suddenly he's making three carries, then I'm thinking, where does he get the energy from? And he has the skill set as well, so a very intelligent player.
And a bit of the dog in him as well.
He has, yeah, yeah, he's aggressive, so it's just managing himself well. So of course he can go on and win 100 caps if he gets a bit of luck and manages himself right. And just in the background, and it could be any kind of a combination here. Will he play Reece Ruddock will probably be there. Jack Conan will start at 8. Dan Levy, of course, Tommy O'Donnell are out. Jordy Murphy comes back in. So does he play Jordy Murphy at 7? Probably will. Kieran Marmion, Keatley or Carberry. I'm not sure what he will do. Does he kind of protect Carberry a little bit, or does he stick him straight in as a 10?
Well, you're saying that his future is at 10, Carberry, so this is the perfect game, is it not, for him to play there?
His future is wherever he wants it to be, okay, yeah. Because I think he's so talented. He's a Beauden Barrett type player that if he's available, he's playing.
Yeah.
Maybe he's not guaranteed that he's playing every time now for Ireland, but pretty soon he will be at that kind of level. Yeah, so he either plays Keatley and puts Joey Carberry full back, where he's been familiar with this year, or plays Carberry at 10. I'm not sure
Murphy,
which way.
Richie Murphy said during the week that they see him as a 10. They don't see him as a fullback.
Yeah, well,
I think
he's the backup 10.
Yeah.
So
if that's the case,
yeah, he'd probably play a 10
given
here.
Given the game time that he's not going to get at Leinster.
And he'd probably take him off at some stage because he's definitely going to be involved next week against Argentina. So he'll bring Ian Keatley on. Then the only guarantees I can see are McCluskey and Farrell will play 10, 12 and 13 here. And then there's a bit of a mixture of Kearney, Sweetenham, Adam Byrne in the back three. So I think there'll be 14, 15 changes in the team.
And actually, it's a pretty exciting team.
It's a good team, yeah.
It's a
good team. I think Fiji have incredible talent, individual talent. It's just the collective coming together. You think of Nakarawa, the Racing player now, who used to play with Glasgow. He's an incredible talent. So he scored a try from against Italy last week. They've unbelievable players in their back line. I think that's a team that Joe will back to go out and do the job.
For an inexperienced team like that Ireland team that you've named, going up against a team like Fiji who are unstructured is actually a really good test for them, because
absolutely,
it's very easy to get sucked into they're throwing the ball around. There's loads of holes everywhere. Let's just throw the ball around and try and find the holes. But actually what Joe Schmidt will want is, we're going to maul, we're going to set up the rooks, we're going to go through the phases. We need to be structured in the phases.
And that's where they'll attack him. They'll attack him at breakdown, they'll attack him at set piece, and they'll try and attack him with relentless pressure, building phases and looking for opportunities there where they outnumber them, and their fitness tells and their work rate tells. So I think any player going out in that field won't be allowed buy into this, well, it's a game of sevens and let's throw the ball around. And he'll put massive pressure, and he'll judge these guys individually. Every player will get their feedback, their game will be broke down from about what they did right, wrong, all the way through. So even though it looks like, well, it's a bit of a blasé affair and it'll be a good game to watch and all that, there'll be a lot of pressure on these guys to deliver.
That's some back row for a second string back row, isn't it? Like, our options there, are they as good as you've ever seen in terms of depth of back row?
Yeah, hugely, I think. I would argue now that back rows in my time were better. No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm only joking there. Listen, it's incredible. You think Dan Levy, Tommy O'Donnell. I feel for Tommy O'Donnell. Obviously, this kind of goes and swings and roundabouts the injuries. You think Jordy Murphy playing against the All Blacks last year, he had an horrendous Achilles injury. He lost ground. Tommy O'Donnell has gained a bit of ground this year with his performances. He's been good for Munster and obviously got a head knock last week in training and missed out in these 2 weeks. So Sean Reedy, again, he's played very well for Ulster. So does, and of course, Jack Conan. Jack Conan is someone who could, you know, really stand out and make a big impact here and keeping the pressure on the three ahead of him.
Yeah, so can Conan play anywhere else? Like, because
he can play six and eight.
He can play six.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I thought Reece Ruddock was fantastic when he came on the other day.
Yeah.
So that keeps Peter O'Mahony in his toes, who hasn't probably had his best start to the season.
There's always a hangover.
Which is understandable,
the
Lions situation. But I thought he was good on Saturday. Now, Peter O'Mahony, Stander was good, Sean O'Brien was good. They worked well together, the our perceived strongest three at the moment.
I remember Reece Ruddock telling us that his dad told him one time, you need to be able to play seven. And he was like, well, you shut up, Dad. What do you know about this? And then he made his debut for Ireland playing seven against Australia.
Yeah, I was on that tour.
And scored a try. And he was like, turns out you do know something, Dad. But the point about that is that he actually can then play six, seven,
and the
eight.
Thing with Reece is he's only got, since that time, and that was 2008... Long time ago, 2010 was it? Sometime around then. Anyway,
my math not so good. I can't remember last week.
He's only got 16 or 17 caps since then.
He's only 27.
He's been unlucky. Yeah, been unlucky. It was 2010. Yeah,
I know he looks about 40, but
he was 20. But he's a great player. I think he's been unlucky with some injuries. But games, I think back to some of the big games he played in. He's been a standout. He's never let the team down, and
this is his peak now, right?
Yeah, he's a chance now to really get in the mix here.
His one difficulty might be that he can kind of play anywhere in that.
That's it. The flexibility again in the back row.
But at least it gets you into the matchday squad.
But
right?
Going back to your question, the depth there in the back row is phenomenal, and they're all great athletic players as well, good footballers.
We tend to take these games for granted, but actually, if you think back to the World Cup in the game against Argentina, where there's that injury crisis the week before and five of the starting team are out through injury and suspension, like, you wouldn't be terribly surprised if five of that team are starting a World Cup quarterfinal against South Africa in 2 years' time.
Yeah, you think Jack McGrath, James Ryan, Ruddock, Jack Conan, McCluskey, Farrell, some of these could come into Adam Byrne, Darren Sweetnam.
Like, it's not a disaster anymore if we do have that type of injury crisis. That's why these games are
You would hope, Ger. I think ultimately when you come down to those crunch deciders, you want a bit of experience behind you, and this is about building experience for the next couple of seasons. Stockdale was incredible last week, so I think he's only going to get better with the experience of being involved. What Carberry's elevation has been just phenomenal. So you think in 2 years' time these guys will have experienced the pressure. Six Nations is a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
Being in those tight environments.
Part of me thinks that maybe the thing to do in this Six Nations is not go hell for leather and say, I realise that the IRFU would have conniptions, particularly after they desperately want to hammer Scotland and Wales now, obviously. But actually picking teams like this, a little bit from last week and a little bit from this week, but more this week than last week.
And your point is valid, but I don't think it'll happen.
No.
But you think of someone like Murray and Sexton, how are we going to manage them up to the World Cup? How vital are they?
I'd give Sexton another 6 months off next year.
Yeah, I'd kind of pick a period where you can. Now, you probably have to tie him down to get him to take some time off, because he's just so determined to keep playing and to affect every match that he plays, and he's incredible. Conor Murray, the same. Someone like Tadhg Furlong, how do you bring him to a World Cup now in 2 years in good shape?
Yeah, like Cian Healy, there was like significant concerns about his career this time last year, and here he is playing the form of his life.
Yeah,
like,
he's definitely been fantastic. Absolutely,
send him
fantastic.
Off around the world, trip for 6 months, and
it won't happen, that situation. But I think, and that is the great beauty, going back to the debate of the Irish guys staying at home. Your time will be managed well here, and I think Joe. Like it or not, sometimes the fans, maybe around the Interpros, we give out that they're all not playing, but their time is managed pretty well here. And if there is a slight niggle going into one of the Pro 14 games, the player gets the weekend off.
Yeah.
And then a younger guy comes in who's actually adding a lot of value to the team as well. So I think it works well, and that's probably the key. Get as many of these guys fit and standing, and get a strong, when he names 30 or 32 players in 2 years to go to Japan, that we see a lot of depth there.
And a lot of disappointed people probably as well. Okay, a couple of quick comments to wrap this up. Derek Higgins says, it's like the Eurovision Song Contest, you'll never know your friends. Except we do know. We know exactly who voted for us.
We know him now. We know him very well.
Yeah, it's not the Welsh and it's not the Scots. Kergal Fearney, which I presume is Fergal Kearney, says, how could Wales and Scotland be so short-sighted? A World Cup in Ireland might even get some Scottish fans going. Would that be a turn-off for the books? The Scots travel in numbers. Like, you'll meet them, and the Scots fans get on quite well with the Irish rugby fans. It's just they're a lick-a-doos and are a lick-a-doos. Yeah. Don't like the look of each other. And John Collins says, I'm delighted I can watch this on YouTube now. Thanks very much for that, John. And you can leave your comments on YouTube as well. And we'll try and bring you whatever ones would get past the censors. Alan, thanks very much for that.
Pleasure, John.
You've been listening to a highlights podcast from OTBAM. If you want to watch us live, we're on Facebook, Twitter and YouTube every morning from 7:45 a.m.